We're needing to move quickly because some of us have other schedules, but we would like to hear SJR 31 first. Ms. Harris, would you tell us a little bit about the proposal?
Thanks, Madam Chair. SJR 31 honors the musical legacy of Oregon jazz artist and composer Jim Pepper. The resolution also encourages the endowment of a Jim Pepper chair at Portland State University and directs that copies of the resolution be delivered to various museums, foundations, and cultural organizations.
Great. Thank you. Do we have a witness list?
Are you trying to speak English today?
No, I can't invite people up to the dais until I have a witness list.
She's rather listless at the moment.
Oh, my gosh.
Feeling rather listless?
Yes.
Please.
We like your fog, Con. Sean, do you want to come up? Is Senator Gordley able to join us this afternoon?
He may still be in committee. She was planning to introduce the bill.
I'm sorry?
She was planning to introduce the bill.
Okay.
But she was going to be brief.
Okay. Anyone from the Pepper family, do you want to come on up? Go ahead, Mr. Curtis.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, and Shields. This is really kind of a remarkable story, and we're really happy to be bringing this forward today. I'm actually saying the kind of things that Senator Gordley was going to be saying.
And she'll be down. She'll be down in just a minute.
Okay. Well,
one sentence.
Why don't we just switch to her then?
Okay. Come on up.
Da-na, 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 da-na.
Good afternoon, Senator Gordley, and I'm sorry I didn't realize you were coming to testify because I didn't have a list. So, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to be very brief and turn this back over to my wonderful and remarkable legislative aide, Sean Cruz. This resolution, for the record, I'm Yvelle Gordley, representing Senate District 23, Northeast and Southeast Portland. This resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 31, honoring the musical legacy of Jim Pepper, comes to you as a result of it being another brilliant idea of my legislative aide, Sean Cruz. And we're just delighted that Jim Pepper's family can be a part of introducing this resolution today. And we just consider it a deep, deep honor to be able to raise up the name and cultural contributions of Jim Pepper and his music, which you will also have the opportunity to hear and enjoy. Again, it's just an honor to be able to bring that gift forward to this body and to all of Oregon. With that said, I'm going to step back and allow Mr. Cruz to describe the content of Senate Joint Resolution 31, and we also are just delighted again that Mr. Pepper's mother, Floyd Pepper, is able to be with us this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Senate Joint Resolution 31 honors the musical legacy of Oregon jazz artist and composer Jim Pepper, and it directs that a copy of the resolution be delivered to the Oregon Historical Society, to the National Museum of the American Indian, and to the Leroy Vinegar Jazz Institute for inclusion in permanent collections. And it encourages the creation and endowment of the Jim Pepper Chair at Portland State University. The joint resolution reads, whereas the 2005 Portland Jazz Festival paid tribute to the musical legacy of Jim Pepper, a true son of Oregon, with a concert dedicated to the late Native American saxophonist and jazz legend, and whereas workshops, panel discussions, performers, and audiences at the festival recalled how Jim Pepper, born to Gilbert and Floyd Pepper in Salem on June 18, 1941, blazed a unique trail across the musical horizon with his innovative synthesis of Native American song, the harmonic structures of modern jazz, and the rhythms of Africa, South America, and the Caribbean. And whereas Jim Pepper performed throughout the United States, Europe, and Africa, played with such jazz giants as Ornette Coleman, Don Cherry, Colin Walcott, Larry Coryell, and Mal Waldron, whereas Jim Pepper also collaborated with many Oregon musicians, including Gordon Lee, Tom Grant, Leroy Vinegar, Nancy King, Karen Knight Pepper, Owo Addy, David Friesen, Dan Balmer, Glenn Moore, Ron Steen, Sonny King, Dennis Springer, Mel Brown, Nick Geffro, Marianne Mayfield, Ralph Black, Lee Reinol, Carlton Jackson, and many others. And whereas Jim Pepper's 1971 crossover hit, Wichitaito, based on a Native American church peyote chant taught to him by his grandfather, earned him a spot on both the jazz and top 40 radio charts, and continues to be widely popular among national and international performers and recording artists to this day. And whereas Jim Pepper's remarkable career was marked by more than 50 recordings as band leader, featured artist, and composer, including Pepper's Pow Wow, Comin' and Goin', and Remembrance, and whereas Jim Pepper's symphony, Four Winds, was performed by the Brooklyn Philharmonic Orchestra in New York and by the Cologne Symphony Orchestra in Germany, and whereas Jim Pepper served as musical director for Night of the First Americans, a Native American self-awareness benefit concert at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. in 1980, and whereas Jim Pepper toured Africa with Don Cherry as part of the United States Africa Cultural Exchange Program, and whereas Jim Pepper succumbed to lymphoid cancer in February 1992 in Portland, Oregon, at age 50, and whereas Jim Pepper was honored posthumously in 1999 with the Lifetime Musical Achievement Award by the First Americans in the Arts and was inducted into the Indian Hall of Fame in 1998 and the Native American Music Awards Hall of Fame in 2000. And whereas Pepper's Pow Wow, the 1996 award-winning documentary of his life, produced and directed by Sandra Osawa and Yasu Osawa, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, was broadcast on PBS in 1997 and 1999, and has since been presented to enthusiastic audiences at the Amiens Film Festival, the Margaret Mead Film Festival, the Native American Film and Video Festival, the Red Earth Film and Video Festival, and the Portland Jazz Festival. And whereas the Leroy Vinegar Jazz Institute and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission named Jim Pepper Jazz Artist of the Year and presented the Bill McClendon Award for Excellence in Jazz to his mother at the 2005 Portland Jazz Festival. And whereas Jim Pepper's music continues to be performed and recorded in countries throughout the world, including Germany, where a performance of Wichitaito by the WDR Radio Orchestra and the Remembrance Band, arranged and conducted by Gunter Schuller, was recorded, and whereas Jim Pepper's life and music harmonized distinct cultures and served as a poetic example for all indigenous people, walking in three worlds with one spirit, and whereas Jim Pepper is survived by his mother, Floyd Pepper, his sister, Suzanne Henry of Portland, his nephews, Jim Pepper Henry and Jesse Laird Henry, and his grandnephew, Jackson Laird Henry. And whereas Floyd Pepper said during her acceptance of her son's First Americans in the Arts Award in 1999, and I quote, Jim Pepper was a member of the Kaw Indian Nation known as the Wind People from his father. From me, his mother, he was a member of the Creek Indian Nation known as the People of the Waters. It's no wonder his music was so strong and powerful, with the wind to carry his music to the four directions of the earth. And as long as the grass shall grow and the waters flow, which is forever, may his spirit remain alive for time immemorial. Close quote. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon, 1. The members of the 73rd Legislative Assembly honor the extraordinary accomplishments and musical legacy of Oregon native son Jim Pepper and direct that a copy of this resolution be delivered to the Oregon Historical Society for inclusion in its permanent collection. 2. The members of the 73rd Legislative Assembly direct that a copy of this resolution be delivered to the National Museum of the American Indian, Smithsonian Institution, Washington, D.C., for inclusion in its permanent collection. 3. The members of the 73rd Legislative Assembly direct that a copy of this resolution be delivered to the Leroy Vinegar Jazz Institute at Portland State University for inclusion in its permanent collection and encourage the creation and endowment of a Jim Pepper Hunga Chieda Flying Eagle Chair at the university to further the study of Native American music and its relationship to jazz. To that, I'd like to add that we were hoping to bring this resolution to the Senate floor during Indian Awareness Week in May, and Jim Pepper Henry, Jim's nephew, who's an official at the Smithsonian Native American Museum, is going to be here that day to accept it, and also that Mayor Tom Potter is going to declare Jim Pepper Day. I believe it's going to be May 20th.
Great. Yes. Wish to add anything, Mrs. Pepper?
Well, at the time Jim was born, I was so afraid he was going to be light-skinned. And I so wanted an Indian boy. And the first thing I said when I came out from under the anesthesia to the doctor was, and startled him no end, I said, "Is he light or is he dark? If he's light, dip him in cocoa." And that was the beginning of Jim's life. And he sort of lived up to that forever.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the fact that you people have considered him honorable enough to include in your resolutions. And I'm very happy, and I'm sure that he and his daddy are stopping dancing all over heaven as receiving this award.
Thank you. Do you wish to add anything? We just need your name for the record.
My name is Suzanne Henry, sister to Jim Pepper. And the Pepper Henry family would like to thank Chair Brown and the committee for allowing us to be here today, and particularly to Shine Cruz and Senator Gordley for bringing this resolution forward. We consider it a really big honor, and we're also pleased that Jim is finally really being recognized in his own state. He probably is more well known on the other side of the continent, and certainly in Europe. So we're very pleased to see this happening. Thank you.
Assuming that gets the appropriate votes, we will be hearing it the week, I think it's the third week in May, as I recall, on the Senate floor, and the family is welcome to sit in the gallery while we talk about his life and as we pass the resolution. So you're welcome to join us at that time. And we thank Senator Gordley and Mr. Cruz for bringing this forward to us. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for
Chair
being
here. We wanted to give Jim an opportunity to speak.
Okay.
And this is a recording. It was recorded in Paris and
Germany.
No, it was recorded in Paris.
Mr. Cruz, we'd actually, I don't know if that, we'd actually like that on the record if we can, and I don't know if you can bring the CD player up and we can get it underneath the microphone, or you can move the mics over, that might be easier.
Just pick it up, you can move that.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay. All right.
And we'll bring them up. We'll bring them up in
You must not forget me when I'm gone, because I love you so dearly, honey. You must not forget me when I'm gone, because I love you so dearly, honey. Wait a minute. See all these feathers up here? See how quiet these feathers are? See these brass feathers? Yeah. That says something, doesn't it? Huh? Yeah. Okay. Yanna ho, yanna wanna ho, yanna ne, ene no way. Yanna ho, yanna wanna ho, yanna ne, ene no way. Yanna ho, yanna ne, yanna ho, yanna ene no way. Yanna ho, yanna wanna ho, yanna ne. Richie Tanto, give me wa, Wahami Korane, Yana Neno, Richie Tanto, give me wa, Wahami Korane, Wahami Korane, Wahami Korane, Richie Tanto, give me wa, Wahami Korane, Yana Neno.
Thank you. Why don't we have Mr. Sylvester come up and testify? It's very nice music, and we'd love to spend the afternoon listening to it. At least I would. They can sit. Yeah.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Robert Sylvester, and I'm the Dean of the School of Fine and Performing Arts at Portland State University. And I thank you very much for having me here to testify on a wonderful, wonderful artist. I'd also like to thank Senator Gordley for her leadership in recognizing the importance of creativity and the enduring legacy of one of Oregon's most creative jazz artists, the Native American saxophonist and legend of jazz, Jim Pepper. Just last week, my colleague, the wonderful jazz pianist Darryl Grant, performed right here in the Senate. He heads our Leroy Vinegar Jazz Institute at PSU and joins me in appreciating your support for jazz in our region. Our work in the School of Fine and Performing Arts includes the creation, preservation, and transmittal of cultures. One of the only United States original art forms, jazz, has been gloriously adapted, interpreted, and advanced by the creativity and spirit of many fine musicians. Jim Pepper's music will always be a brilliant example of how art speaks to us all. Think of it. Jazz and Native American music are among a very few truly American art forms. We celebrate this in Jim Pepper's music and in his memory. It is fitting and worthy that Oregon recognizes the outstanding contributions to our culture by artists such as Jim Pepper. By your resolution today, you are planting a seed that, with time, may grow to become a legacy that ensures that young people may come to know the spirit and creativity that he is so warmly regarded for. Our work at the university is to identify and cultivate that creativity, and we are eager to assist in that effort for this generation and those to come. I bring today a portrait of some of the finest jazz artists in our region. Modeled after the famous 1958 Art Caine photograph in Harlem, this too is a way of recognizing the accomplishments and rich treasures that our artist represents while they are still with us. Leroy Vinegar and the late, I must say, great Jim Pepper, two admiring colleagues, are jazz legends who passed on prior to this recent historic photograph. However, through so many great jazz artists pictured here, their legend and music live on. In recognition of Jim Pepper's over 50 recordings to his credit, his musical voice lives on. He is recognized for his musical fusion with symphony orchestras on two continents. The 1996 documentary Pepper's Powwow premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and has captivated PBS and other film festival audiences ever since. Jim Pepper's life has cameoed Native American experiences through jazz, and I am honored to bring his name forward for your consideration. We will take this resolution on and incorporate it into the Leroy Vinegar Institute, as well as incorporating it into our Native American programs at PSU. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. Thank you, Mrs. Pepper. Thank you, Ms. Henry Pepper. Any questions, Ms. Pepper Henry? Any questions for this panel?
It's not a question, Madam Chair, but I had a chance to meet these fine ladies just a couple of days ago and to listen to the album a little bit that you have in your hand. You know, it's just an amazing experience, so I just wanted to be here this afternoon for this.
And the CD that we played is from Jim Pepper, Flying Eagle, live at New Morning Paris. So, a little unpaid announcement. We'll pass it down. So, any other comments or questions? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing and open a work session. Senator Shields.
I move that SJR 31 be moved to the floor, and I'm not sure of the wording, but with a do pass, or is it
a do adopt. Senator Shields has moved SJR 31 to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, it's so ordered. And Senator Gordley, if you're feeling up to it, we'd ask you to carry the resolution on the floor. So,
cheers.
Thank you very much. All right. We're going to move to 2500.
Okay.
You owe me more music.
That was fabulous music. We're going to move to House Bill 2500. Ms. Harris, would you tell us a little bit about the bill? And Ms. Nielsen will bring up the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2500 requires that state-operated drug and alcohol treatment programs, that would include, for example, court-mandated substance abuse treatment programs, comply with standards promulgated by the Department of Human Services.
All right. Ms. Merriweather, Mr. Piper, and Mr. Treleaven? Close enough? Treleaven? Trevelin? Treleaven. The accent on the wrong syllable.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am here today on behalf of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program Association of Oregon, and they are the community not-for-profit providers of alcohol and drug treatment. Okay. I'm going to just very briefly introduce the context for the bill and what we're trying to achieve and sort of bring you up to speed, and then let my two companions who can speak far more articulately to the issues address the bill and answer your questions. House Bill 2500 comes to you from the House Health and Human Services Committee, where it passed out unanimously and actually passed the House on consent unanimously. What this bill does is very simply requires that alcohol and drug treatment providers who provide to clients who are directed to them through community corrections meet the same standards for licensure and certification that are required of those providers who provide for people who come to them through the Department of Human Services. It's really just a standardization of qualifications and care. This is something that we worked through the interim with the Department of Corrections in order to develop. It is something that they are supportive of and have agreed with us as something that needed to be addressed, needed to be standardized and corrected. So that is the short version. I'd be happy to answer questions. Other than that, I will defer to my two companions. Okay, go ahead.
My name's Rick Treleaven. I'm the president of the Alcohol and Drug Programs Association of Oregon. I'm also executive director of Best Care Treatment Services in Central Oregon, Ben Redman and Madras. I have two unique statements to give to this committee, even recognizing the experience on this committee. The first unique statement is to answer their burning question, what does a can of beans have in similarity to a set of Oregon administrative rules? That's probably a question you've never been asked before, and I won't ask you to answer it. But the first job I ever had was at Libby's in South Salem here, working in the bean cannery in graveyard shift, and my job was to sweep up all the rotten beans and make sure they went away. This rule allows us basically to sweep up the rotten beans in the field of addiction services so that all programs be able to meet a basic, simple standard. That's all we're asking. So we're looking for a basic floor. Now, what happens is that the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services goes out and inspects each of our programs. You get either a 1, 2, 3-year letter of approval, or you get conditions that you need to meet. For us A&D providers, this little piece of paper here is gold. It's a letter of approval that we all scramble and take very, very seriously from that inspection. Now, the question really is this set of inspection, rulemaking, is this bureaucratic, cumbersome, difficult to deal with? Here's the second unique statement you've probably never heard a provider say before, but the rules that we have to live under, these 24 and a half pages, is a masterpiece. Note that, OAR's masterpiece of conciseness and focus and clarity. I'm a mental health director. Also, the mental health rules that I live under are a large binder. So again, they allow us to have a basic floor that gives the term treatment some basic meaning. Why do we need this? Is basically, in addiction treatment, we have a soundbite. You've heard it probably, or hopefully you've heard it. This treatment works. But it's true for all sound bites. Reality is a bit more complicated. What we know is that well-designed and professionally delivered treatment will help most people. What HB 2500 does is ensure that programs that receive state funding meet these basic standards for effective treatment. When we have an unregulated system, there's no agreed-upon minimum standard of care. And therefore, anything can be called treatment. So who would be affected? Right now, all the programs funded with DHS dollars have to live under these rules. There are a handful of programs funded through Department of Corrections that have, at times, not... have gone to providers that have not used these rules, not had to live up to these standards. And Department of the Oregon Youth Authority is another group. For all these programs, the impact should be relatively minor because most of the programs already require that the providers have a letter of approval, and every county in the state has programs that meet this letter of approval. What would be the cost? Here's the sweet one. Oh, my word, I've gotten the chair of the committee yawning.
Just needed some oxygen. Don't take the person.
Is that there would be no cost for implementing this for $2,500 because in all the communities there are current providers that can meet the standard. So that would be my testimony, and I can certainly answer any questions of the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Bruce Piper. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of ADAPT in Roseburg and Grants Pass and Coos Bay, and a board member of the Oregon Treatment Network. I want to start by apologizing for this bill. It has to be one of the most exceptionally boring bills that you will have the pleasure to read. Okay. It basically has one operative sentence. Alcohol and drug programs shall meet DHS standards. Some have characterized it as a housekeeping bill. I would agree with that characterization. Let me describe for you very briefly some relevant history of Oregon administrative rules. And I will start by saying I am not a fan of increasing regulation. For about 16 years, I've been a very bitter critic of Oregon administrative rules. Felt like they were excessively cumbersome, required an astonishing amount of time of clinicians be spent pushing paper, rather than working directly with people. Our provider meetings historically were dominated by complaints and angry comments about administrative rules until about 5 years ago, when after a legislative budget note requiring at that time ODAP to streamline their administrative rules, a number of us, and I was one, participated in a work group to look at the rules and attempt to streamline them. And our task was not to set the bar so high that every program had to provide or produce a Mercedes, but rather a very solid vehicle that anyone would look at and say, this program is doing a good job spending taxpayers' money in terms of their outcomes. The result of that work group is that over the last 5 years, I have not heard one provider say anything critical about the minimum standards that we developed. Rick referred to him as a masterpiece. As you can tell, he's occasionally full of beans, so he's a little bit hyperbole. But
you guys have been practicing this one.
Well, one previous time before the House, as a matter of fact. Here's some pertinent questions about this bill. Why wouldn't we want all such publicly funded programs to meet agreed-upon minimum standards? We think they should. Do we want the same service provided in two different places to be governed by Oregon administrative rules in one place but not the other? From our perspective in the field, we don't think that's good practice. If we were agreeable to using public funds to provide services without minimum standards in some places, then why require those same minimum standards with services provided elsewhere? We think that Oregon law and Oregon administrative rules should be applied consistently, and they currently are not. What can be done without this bill? Well, community corrections, county jails, the Oregon Youth Authority, the Department of Corrections, the Commission on Children and Families, the Department of Education can either contract or provide directly publicly funded treatment without meeting minimum Oregon administrative rule standards that all existing treatment programs generally are required to meet in every county in Oregon. I don't think that makes sense to have that loophole. My final comment is, last session we passed very important legislation, Senate Bill 267, which established that in ascending percentages, Oregon's entire publicly funded system will be based on evidence-based practices. This bill is a spiritual kin to Senate Bill 267. You have to have minimum standards upon which to build evidence-based practices. That's exactly what we believe that this bill will accomplish, is to standardize those standards across the state and provide a very firm foundation to build evidence-based practices for the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. You know, it sounds to me like this would essentially take flexibility away from Department of Corrections and Youth Authority in terms of choosing who they want to provide this kind of treatment. In other words, you don't trust them to make the right decision. Right now they could choose a licensed provider, correct?
Okay. Correct.
And you want to make sure that they don't have the discretion to choose somebody that is not licensed.
Correct.
The letter of approval, right.
We simply want, wherever public funds are buying alcohol and drug treatment services, to have the same standards apply as they currently apply to most of the system.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Senator.
I understand that, but you know, to me, you are taking away their flexibility, and the question is, do we trust their decision-making or don't we? You're saying, well, we don't trust them to make the right decision. We want to force them to use a treatment facility that has received a letter of approval.
Madam Chair, from my perspective, who they choose is entirely up to them, and that wouldn't limit that at all. It would simply require that whoever they are using, including themselves, that they would be required to meet minimum standards.
Sarah
Ringo.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
between sessions, we did go to the Department of Corrections first with this concern, and this was something that they did want to see happen, and but don't have the current authority to see happen.
They did or didn't?
They did.
But you say they don't have the current authority. Right now, they can choose who they contract with.
What I mean is the state Department of Corrections does not have the authority to require this of the county corrections programs.
Okay. So the state, they can't force the county corrections. Madam Chair?
I mean,
just a comment. I mean, we are building more regulations, and we are taking away flexibility from local entities to spend dollars how they want to spend it. And maybe there's a good reason to do that. Maybe there's a great reason to do that. That's what we're doing. Right?
Right. And,
okay.
And again, what I think the question is back to the quality standard of the beans, which is why I started that out, is there a system to toss out the rotten beans? And what our perspective is that this is a pretty minimal standard for folks to be able to meet. And there's all sorts of reasons that go on, and the majority of times the contracting bodies do require that they go to a licensed provider because they see the benefits of that. That in the real world, that doesn't always happen that way. And so it's rare that it doesn't, but it does occur that way. So we want to see that happen most, all the time.
Yeah. Just to follow up, Madam Chair. I think I'm a yes on the bill, but I just do want to make that comment that this is moving control from a local level to a state level, giving less flexibility to local folks in how to spend money. Just a comment.
Sorry. Anyone else? Sarah Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The letter of approval process is laid out in Rick's testimony, lists the use of evidence-based practices as the last bullet. Can you tell me more about that? What percentage of evidence-based programs is stipulated in the DHS rules? We were pretty clear in our mandate to the Department of Corrections that by the end of the last biennium, 25% of our treatment programs would be evidence-based. By the end of this biennium, it's supposed to be half. Tell me more about the evidence-based programs that would be available or at least expand on what DHS requirements are for evidence-based treatment programs.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I can tell you that OMHAS has published a list of an extensive list of specific evidence-based practices that are being incorporated into programs around the state. I'm unaware, but then I haven't seen any of the newest round of contracts. If there are any specific contract language requirements in there, I would assume that there are, but I've yet to see them. The percentage, as I understand it, I think you just said it was 25%. That's certainly consistent with what our expectation has been. So we're as fast as we can participating in work groups here in Salem and as a field attempting increasingly to build those practices into the services we provide.
And as both the A&D director and a mental health director, I have to say that on the alcohol and drug side, it's much easier to build this in, and we are far ahead on the alcohol and drug treatment side than we are in the more complex arena of mental health. So in the programs I run personally, the majority of the services we are providing are built around evidence-based practices right now.
Sarah Ferrioli.
It looks like most of the addiction treatment programs function by letter of approval. Isn't that the kind of relationship that this formalizes? You make a requirement in this bill that the state funded programs have to comply with the 21-page rule, but most of the programs operated by the counties already do that through a letter of approval process. So what are we really adding here? You know, just mandating the few programs out there that don't have a letter of approval to get a compliant letter of approval, because they're already functioning in that manner.
Correct. Most of the vast majority of the programs, and certainly all programs run through the local mental health authority, have to meet the standard. What we've seen is there's a few outlier programs where they get funding not through DHS but through other state agencies that are able to avoid this process, and that's all that we're trying to get. And it's pretty small but meaningful in places.
And Madam Chairman, I want to revisit the first question. I'm not really sure I understood the answer. We're dealing with substance abuse programs, and I guess I need to know whether or not Senate Bill 2500 or the rules that have been adopted by DHS mandate the use of evidence-based programs.
Yes, we are all come under that mandate.
And Madam Chair, just a
Senator Marielli.
Can you characterize whether or not the mandate has a benchmark? Is there a measurable progress as we built into the alcohol and drug treatment facility or programs in corrections?
Are you familiar with
the I can give you one example. On the 27th of this month, my program will be measured by the what's called the CPAI, the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory, that the DOC has adopted as their baseline measurement tool for assessing programs and their compliance with evidence-based practices.
So, Madam Chairman, will vendors be, if vendors are going to be, or service providers are going to be assessed, is there a quantitative value that comes out of that assessment that I could look at and say, okay, half of their programs are evidence-based?
I honestly don't know, since my program is going to be measured for the first time coming up. What they've told me is that this is baseline information, and this is what they're going to be using from this point forward as the gold standard.
Okay. Madam Chairman, I have no familiarity 24-page masterpiece that we're.
Why don't you study it for us and bring it back, a synopsis for us on Thursday?
Madam Chairman, I think that's what we have staff for.
Okay.
Ms. Harris, I'd be glad to see a very brief bulleted, because if we're tearing one to the other, and basically there's the mandate, and I have no idea what the 24 pages mandates. I'm really in a position asking folks to comply with a rule I don't understand. But if it's such a good read,
it's real.
Enjoy it.
Senator Farrielly, we will set this bill. We'll finish the public hearing, and then we won't move forward on work session today and give everybody an opportunity to read the entire manual. So, Ms. Harris has volunteered to convene a study club. Okay, this is degrading rapidly. I'm going to close the public hearing unless anybody had any other questions. Thank you very much. We appreciate your trying to make this interesting and stimulating. You did a great job. Moving to public hearing on House Bill 2774. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2774 extends the time for an elector in an irrigation district to obtain a replacement ballot. Under current law, an elector in an irrigation district can obtain a ballot up to the fifth calendar day prior to an election. Under House Bill 2774, the same elector would be able to obtain a replacement ballot up till the close of polls on Election Day.
Thank you. We have one person signed up to testify. Ms. McNitt, why don't you come forward? Is there anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2774? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress, which is a trade association of primarily special districts, local governments, organized for the delivery of irrigation district water. House Bill 2774 was brought to you at our request. It's a simple bill. The main action is on the second page. What it does is it allows districts who conduct elections as a public entity, they're regulated under ORS Chapter 545, it allows us to provide a replacement ballot to qualified electors up until the time that the polls close. Currently, state law restricts us to 5 days before the election is over, and we would just like to make it similar to other elections that are conducted by other election officials. And that's the sum total of the bill, Madam Chair.
Was there any objection in the House, Ms. McNitt?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there was no objection. This managed to move out on the consent calendar and is a good government bill. And I'm pleased to say I think I could deliver it in less than 5 minutes.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. McNitt?
No.
Okay. But I'm going to put this is not a huge issue for my district, so I'm going to put this ball in the court of those who actually might have an impact in their district.
Madam Chair, are we in work session?
Not yet, but I can if you want to be.
March away.
Okay. You okay? All right. We're going to move into work session. House Bill 2774. Senator Atkinson.
I'd be delighted to move it.
Senator Atkinson.
To the floor with a due pass.
Is delighted
recommendation.
To move House Bill 2774 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just so nobody waters it down.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. And Senator Atkinson, we would love to have you carry this bill.
I would be delighted.
Okay.
He'll be glad to carry their water.
Thank you.
Oh. All right. We'll move into work session on Senate Bill 161. Ms. Harris, why don't you refresh our memory? Does anybody from the Secretary of State's office want to come forward and talk about the amendments? Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee heard Senate Bill 161 in January.
When we were young and happy.
At the beginning of the session. There were some questions about the provision that would allow the Secretary of State, after consultation with county clerks, to postpone the date of an election in the event of a natural disaster. Most of the questions centered around the extent of the Secretary of State's discretion to determine what type of emergency would warrant the postponement of elections, under what circumstances that would occur, et cetera. And so the Dash 1 amendments that we have before us are intended to address some of those concerns, and I'll let the Secretary of State's office take it from here.
Fire away, guys.
Hi, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jesse Cornett, the legislative liaison for the Secretary of State's office. Thanks for bringing this bill back up. After the first hearing, we took another look and have the Dash 1 amendments. There was some concern with the amount of discretion this would give the office and the vagueness of the language. What we have done is gone back, taken a look, and have where the governor will actually issue a proclamation to postpone an election, and only after the Secretary of State consults with the county clerks and requests the governor do so, may he do such a proclamation. So it at the very least, requires the action of two statewide elected officials, including the chief elections officer and the governor, to postpone an election in case of emergency. That, without rehashing the testimony we gave in January, is what the amendments do. And I'd be happy to take any questions on the original bill or the amendments.
Thank you. Good work, you guys. I'm impressed. Questions for this panel? None? Okay.
Statements.
Senator Farioli.
When I first encountered this bill, I hated
speeches.
Hated the bill. But I believe that requiring the chief elections officer of the state and the chief executive officer of the state in concert with the elections officials at the county level to consult and to make these decisions, and then only for a very brief window, 15 days, makes this bill a very logical extension of the executive power and the authority of the Secretary of State's office. So I have no objections to the bill, as amended.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Well, as long as we're giving speeches. I'm a no on this bill because I think elections should be as objective as possible. And I hate the idea of injecting subjectivity into the outcome of election. And, you know, let's say there's an emergency that closes down a road or shuts down a city or a tsunami wipes out the South Coast or something. Well, then blame it on God, but you're not going to say that the governor, the secretary of state, or somebody was kind of trying to game some election. And so,
all right.
I'm an
all right. We are in work session. The chair would move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 161. Any objection? So ordered. The chair would move Senate Bill 161 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion or speeches? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Ringo?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes
question,
aye.
Procedural question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I was just wondering if Senator Atkinson and Senator Ringo would like to
I was wondering that myself. I would look for
a minority report. We'd have the first bipartisan opportunity for a minority report in the legislative
Let me finish. The motion passes. Would the two of you like to serve notice of minority report? The relating clause is quite broad.
How much trouble does he get into if I serve notice of it?
None at all, as long as he's willing to do it with you.
If he will.
I mean, relating to election.
Huge relating clause.
Oh, give us a night.
Okay. Senator Atkins and Senator Ringo serve.
Atkinson.
Sorry.
Senator Ringo.
Serve notice of in the minority report. We look forward to your creative and intellectual ideas and debate on the floor. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Is any further business to come before the committee? Seeing none, we're adjourned. See you guys tomorrow.
Yes, sir.